You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out when and why humans first made wild cats their pets about 10,000 years ago. Now, wild bison used to roam Wisconsin hundreds of years ago, but overhunting and habitat destruction eliminated them in the wild. Several thousand remain on farms in the state today, and a few tribal groups are joining in a wider effort to reintroduce the bison to tribal lands and their cultures. This winter, the Menominee Nation and the Forest County Potawatomi community each received 10 bison through a partnership with U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Nature Conservancy, and the Intertribal Buffalo Council. Anaquette is the executive director of the Menominee community organization, Menikonikum. He's a traditional Menominee who lives on the Menominee Reservation. He also goes by the name Guy Ryder. Anaquette, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little more, please, about this partnership that brought these bison.
Yeah, so, you know, with any project, a really good project, you want to have some good partners. And in this endeavor, we definitely had good partners. You mentioned some of them, you know, the Menominee Indian tribe here in Wisconsin, you know, our tribe, the tribe that I'm from. Also, you know, the Intertribal Buffalo Council and the Nature Conservancy. And I would be remiss to make sure I include, you know, a lot of our employees there at Menikonikum. You know, Mike Fish, Brian Donovan, Maurice Wapoos, Brian Greeno, and our youth group who really put a lot of effort into this project.
What is your plan for these bison now?
Well, you know, you kind of mentioned a little bit in the intro there of how long these buffalo have been around. You know, they've been here for time immemorial, as we too, as the Menominee people, are the original people of the land. You know, we've had a special relationship with them for lots of years, and through colonization and through all the things that we went through as a community, that you know, connection has been fragmented, and we've definitely wanted to bring those animals home here and you know, reestablish that relationship and rebuild that beautiful connection.
And speaking of connections, I understand in Wisconsin, a lot of people are interested, I think, in restoring prairies and grasslands in the state. And these bison once played a really big ecological role in that system. Can you talk about that a little and how you're, I think, hoping to recreate some of that?
Yeah, we definitely are. You know, the land that we are currently on used to be, you know, a farm, but it laid vacant for probably 7 years before we got it in 2017, and they did, you know, the natural practices that you do at farms. But we wanted to, you know, come at it a different way and learning more about our relative, the buffalo, and understanding that they're ecological engineers and that they actually, you know, bring more benefit to the land and to really the whole ecosystem. So, you know, that was one of the things, the major benefits that helped us to really make this project, you know, go forward and getting that sort of education out there, making sure, you know, people understand that these aren't cows, you know, this isn't cattle, but that these are, you know, wild animals, and they were originally here, you know, and played a major role in the ecosystem.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the land that they're going to be on and the lives they're going to lead on that land?
Yeah. So right now, you know, we started with 10, like you said, in the opening there. I'm hoping to grow that number. Right now we have 66 acres, you know, for those 10 buffalo. But we have eyes on some more land, hopefully working with the Menominee Indian tribe to be able to get some more land. We want to grow that herd to what the land can stand. We don't want to, you know, necessarily say we're going to do 1,000 cattle in 1 acre. You know, we want to make sure we have enough room for them to be able to thrive and benefit our community. That's the big part of that, is making sure that, you know, the connection with the people and with our community, we start to rebuild all that.
Yeah, you've started to touch on this a little. Can you talk about the cultural significance to you of having this species, this native species to Wisconsin, back on the land?
Yeah, you know, historically for us, you know, one of our great chiefs, Chief Oshkosh, was the last person, you know, to have the buffalo ceremony, the buffalo headdress and all those, you know, articles that went with that. And it was such an important ceremony for our people, because it also, you know, brought goodwill in anybody that had that dream of that buffalo would meet with the Buffalo Society, and it would bring good feelings to the community and to the people. So that was a major, component for us to make this decision. But also, you know, far back into our history, you know, even before we were Menominees and we emerged out of the mouth of the Menominee River, our great hero, you know, Manabusi, he walked this land, and he had that connection with those buffalo as well. And there's many, many, many teachings behind it. We're just hoping, you know, that we can bring some of that back, and definitely, you know, we're not experts or trying to be anything but other than students and learning and connecting and trying to do it in a good way.
What are you hoping this Buffalo Project looks like, say, 5 or 10 years from now?
Well, I'm hoping that our whole community gets involved, you know, with our buffalo. I hope that at that point that we're rebuilding that connection with them, that we see them more as just a food source, but we see them as like a relative, as a part of our tribe, as a part of our people. You know, who knows that down in the future, you know, when it comes time to, you know, maybe harvesting one, that we have the support of the community, we do it in a traditional way, we do it in a way, you know, that reflects our culture, that reflects the way we see and do things, and we do it in a loving way. We're really open to lots of things. And I think there's a good part of it is the unknown. You know, we want to make sure this is a reciprocal relationship with the buffalo and make sure that they too have a say in the direction in which we go. So there's a bit of unknown there too, but you know, whatever's going to happen, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be great, and it's going to grow.
Anaquette, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, thank you. You know, Rob, before I go, I just wanted to make sure that if people did have, you know, further questions, mm-hmm. that they could look at our website, www.MenominiRebuilders.com, and you can definitely find more information there and contact information.
We'll get that up on our WPR.org/Central Time page. Anaquette, thanks again.
Yes, thank you, sir.
Anaquette is the executive director of the Menominee Community Organization, Menikonikum. With us today to share more about the Menominee Nation's plan for 10 bison or buffalo it received to reintroduce to the land and their culture. And again, we'll have a link to that Menominee Rebuilders organization at WPR.org/Central Time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Maureen McCollum shares a story about living with Wisconsin's winter weather and talking about it.
Comedian Esteban Tuma is taking time to reflect on cold weather in Wisconsin. Born and raised in Ecuador, the state's severe winters have tested him. But an even greater challenge for Tuma has been acclimating to how much Wisconsinites like to talk about the weather.
As I step out of the deep freeze and unwrap 6 layers of winter gear in the lobby, I see Wendy from HR approaching. It's on. I'm trapped. It's time for small talk. Am I scared? Of course. This is not your average banter. This is Wisconsin small talk. And I'm facing Wendy herself, the queen of chit-chat. She's in the big leagues. As she approaches with the warmest smile, I start to sweat. This is not amateur hour.
Esteban!
She shouts, eyes sparkling.
I almost didn't make it. I have no idea why I even got out of bed today,
she says, pointing at the blizzard outside. This is why she's a legend, not even a
hey.
No sign of a
oh, how are you?
The worst thing about Wisconsin's winter is not that it sucks. It does. It's that you're forced to talk about it. A lot. But I don't even flinch. I've been training. Big smile, hands on hips, strong eye contact. The only thing that got me out of bed, I say, skipping a beat for maximum effect, was coffee. She bursts into laughter. Oh, how we chuckle and howl. Maybe Wendy from HR has finally met her match. When I arrived in Madison 6 years ago, I was unprepared. When animals meet, they growl, display their plumage, or sniff butts. Small talk in Wisconsin seemed like a similar show of dominance, and I wanted no part of it. As an immigrant from South America, I tried hard to avoid it, arriving late to all meetings, speaking Espanol to my Uber driver, or keeping it under 12 items so I could use the self-checkout machine at the grocery store. As Wendy and I move slowly down the hall, I feel like I'm doing great. She talks about the unpredictability of March, I mention Al Gore, and we share a moment of silence for the polar bears.
Aww.
I wonder to myself why Wisconsinites are so keen on this. There's no need for small talk where I'm from. Quito, Ecuador is a pretty big cosmopolitan city where we kiss hello with strangers, quickly compliment each other, and go on our way. Our social connections involve salsa music, Catholicism, and all those germs from smooching strangers. When Wendy and I reach the end of the hallway, I realize we're going in opposite directions, but we linger. Too much is on the line, and I will not go gently into that.
Have a good day!
But I must confess, compared to the frozen gray outside, Wendy's casual banter is making me feel warm inside, and I start to understand. I imagine early settlers who, after setting up and getting comfortable during the Wisconsin summer, endured their first winter weather. What stopped them from packing up and heading south? Maybe someone rolled their eyes mid-blizzard and joked, "Nice day out there, huh?" And the extended chatter that followed lasted until it was time to collect berries, split logs, go fishing, and run from bears or whatever. Wendy helped me understand that. Sure, the weather sucks, but that's a small price to pay for the ability to connect with your neighbors about how much it sucks. As far as who won our small talk showdown, neither of us gave it up. So after 42 minutes and two follow-up emails, we decided we are getting married! We're looking at dates for next summer, or as we here in Wisconsin like to call it, road construction season.
Esteban Tuma is a comedian in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a researcher tells us when and where humans first domesticated cats, or mostly domesticated them. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Humans and cats live side by side, maybe in your house and in many cultures around the world. But how did all that get started? Our next guest has been researching the earliest origins of domesticated cats, or as domesticated as they get, anyway. Dr. Leslie Lyons is a professor of comparative medicine at the University of Missouri College of Veterinary Medicine and author of a recent paper on the genetic origins of our modern feline friends. Dr. Lyons, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Yeah, wonderful to be with you, Rob. Great to be on WPR.
Take us back to the Fertile Crescent. You're talking 10,000 years. What do we know about when cats and humans first started living together?
Well, we know that it probably all started side by side. Humans were in the Fertile Crescent, and they were well on their way to being farmers and developing large grain stores and staying in one area and developing garbage piles. So in came the mice and the rats because they were getting a good, free, easy meal. And so the local wildcats really discovered, hey, this is a pretty good gig. If I get used to being around humans, then I can probably get pretty good, easy, free meals as well. And so we think that's why we think cats pretty much somewhat domesticated themselves. Their behavioral change allowed them to be more bold, get close to humans, and then humans provided more protection and more food, which is what any animal wants in their life.
Now, when we're talking about domesticated animals, one question could be whether we're talking cats or dogs or horses or livestock or whatever. Did we do this once in human history and then it spread, or did we do it over here this time and over there this time? What does it look like when it comes to cats?
Yeah, that question was exactly one of the things we were looking at in the study. We know that agriculture developed in pretty much three major hubs in the Fertile Crescent, in the Indus Valley, and the Yellow Ridge River region of China. So did cats independently get domesticated by those local farmers, or did it happen one place, and with knowledge and trade, did it get moved around, did domestic cats move around the world? And so from our study, we have good DNA sampling from cats in the Indus Valley in Pakistan, from the Yellow River region in China, and of course from the Fertile Crescent. And it really looks like even though cats are very genetically distinct in the Far East as compared to Western Europe, it looks like they all kind of started in the middle in the Near East and then spread from one place, from one site of cat domestication in the Near East, which is supported by other studies that have been done just on the wild cats in the region as well.
And that's taking us to the heart of your research. You looked at DNA of cats alive today. Can you talk about that sort of, I guess, reverse detective work? How did you do this?
That's right. Yeah. So you can do studies by looking at ancient DNA, but we were actually looking at the extant, the living DNA. And so from looking at that, we can say, well, where is the biggest hub of cat genetic diversity? Where are the cats the most diverse? That would mean those are probably the oldest populations to be present. And so when we looked at populations from all over the world, we looked at Australia and North America, and then all throughout Eurasia as well. And certainly the most diverse populations are in the Near East in the Fertile Crescent region, whether that's Turkey or Iraq or Egypt. Those are very highly diverse regions. So because of that high diversity, we think the cats started there. And then as they spread out, their diversity lowered a little bit just from isolation. And then some of the cats on the fringes became more genetically distinct.
Talking to Dr. Leslie Lyons from the University of Missouri College of Veterinary Medicine about her research on the origins of domesticated cats. Dr. Lyons, was there a genetic change in cats that came along with domestication? Did they evolve differently once they started hanging out with humans?
We certainly think that to be true, but we don't know what those specific genetic changes may have been. They're generally associated with behavioral changes. A cat had to somehow decide, I want to be more bold, and by being more bold, I'll get closer to humans and allow humans to help with my comfort, with my feeding, with protection. And so there had to be some amount of behavioral change that was involved. But some of the early changes that we can see are coat colors. So any cat that looks like Sylvester the cat or Garfield, the all-orange cat, those are genes that we don't find in the wild. Those mutations are not found in the wild, but found in our domesticated cats. So that means people early on involved with the domestication said, hey, I like that cat, or I like that cat, which is called novelty selection, and perpetuated that cat. So then that's how we have all these cool coat colors and fur types in random bred cats all over the world, but not in our wild cat subspecies.
I joked earlier that cats are only sort of domesticated, except no joke, you use the phrase semi-domesticated to refer to cats. What does that mean?
Yes, we have to remember that domestication is a process. It's not on or off, you're domesticated or you're not. Why we say cats are semi-domesticated, we kind of think they're kind of still early in the domestication process, that if most house cats, random bred cats, what we call or sometimes called community cats, feral cats, barn cats, if you turn them loose, they're going to do perfectly fine. They know how to do all their hunting properly. They'll be able to procure their food, have babies, and perpetuate their species. Where other of our domesticated animals, if we just turned them all loose, they would have a bit harder of a process to go through. So with cats, that's kind of why we say they're semi-domesticated. They're just not as far along on the domestication scale as what we might find dogs or other species.
Now, you've done this genetic detective work on cats. I understand you're hoping to do similar things with other species, including, do I have this right, humans?
No, that's not something we would be looking
okay.
at. I mean, that certainly has already been done by various other good research groups. And what we find actually with the cats is that they do kind of follow humans as far as their migration processes. And so we do see that with humans.
What questions do you still want to answer when it comes to cats in particular?
Well, we would like to do more studies on wild cats themselves. There are wild cats in the Near East and Northern Africa and also in Europe that live today. So that's what's also unusual about cats. Their progenitor species is actually still alive. But we don't have good sampling of those wild cats from different areas. So is there more than one subspecies? that contributed to the domestic cats. That is not yet well defined. And we might be able to see that from more ancient DNA studies as well. So we know that various different collaborators are actively working on that aspect of cat evolution and domestication.
Briefly, one thing I'm wondering, it's got to be pretty easy to get modern cat DNA. How easy or hard is it to get ancient 10,000-year-old domesticated cat DNA?
Yeah, any ancient DNA is quite a process. You have better success when you have your specimen coming from the permafrost that has been frozen for quite a long time. Cats, much of the stuff people always think, oh, Egypt, all those mummified cats. Well, mummification and the heat in Egypt is not good with DNA. They don't like one another. So it destroys a lot of the DNA. But we have been able to get some DNA out of two or three different cat mummies. And we have shown that the DNA signature, the DNA profile of those mummified cats is the same profile that we see in modern day Egyptian and Near Eastern cats. And that profile is kind of unique to that region and not found throughout the world. So that does mean the cats of the pharaohs are present in the cats of modern Egypt.
Dr. Lyons, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
My pleasure, and you guys have a wonderful day up there in Wisconsin.
You too. That's Dr. Leslie Lyons with the University of Missouri College of Veterinary Medicine talking about her research pinpointing the domestication of cats in the Middle East about 10,000 years ago. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we may not be able to stop worrying, but we can do it better, more productively, in ways that give us less stress. Get some psychological advice for better worrying, that and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then House Republicans use their first policy vote as the majority party in the chamber to act on a promise to cut funding for the IRS. We'll find out what's at stake. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the FDA approved a drug that could help slow cognitive decline and improve brain function for people in the early stages of Alzheimer's. A doctor joins us for a look at the potential benefits and some concerns. First, after a rocky week of voting repeatedly on who would replace Democrat Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, House Representatives and new Speaker Kevin McCarthy opened this week by targeting the Internal Revenue Service. With their first policy vote after getting a slim majority in the House, Republicans introduced a bill that would rescind more than $70 billion in funding for the IRS over the next 10 years. That's out of a total of $80 billion that Congress approved for the agency as part of the Inflation Reduction Act passed last year. The Democratic-controlled Senate probably won't take up that bill, but the move in the House demonstrates a priority to cut funding for the federal tax agency. It may not be the last attempt of its kind. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the current funding level, staffing level, capacity of the Internal Revenue Service? Do you support stripping some of that new IRS funding away? Do you think it should hold on to what it's been given? Have you interacted with the IRS lately, tried to call in, say, did you get an answer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen Rosenthal is a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. He researches, speaks, and writes on a range of federal income tax issues with a focus on business taxes. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be here.
Let's talk about this funding that's in stake. We've talked about it a little bit in the past, this Inflation Reduction Act money that went to the IRS. What was it supposed to do?
Well, that money was supposed to bolster the IRS's efforts both to serve taxpayers and to enforce the tax law, about half and half. The IRS needed a whole bunch of modernization, and they also needed a lot of personnel replacement because the IRS workforce is aging. And, you know, interestingly enough, the IRS has been loaded with more and more responsibilities over the last decade or so, with less and less budget. So it needed help.
There's been talk of adding 87,000 new IRS employees. In calling for this funding cut, employees cross that out, replace it with agents. Republicans say 87,000 agents are being added under this funding. Can you sort out that distinction for us?
Well, there's a lot of mythology around the 87,000 number. At least you didn't say the 87,000 would be armed and packing. Mm-hmm. But the 87,000 includes customer service reps, tech workers, as well as agents. Only about half of the money would be going to enforcement side of things. And so I would imagine far fewer than the 87,000 would go for enforcement. And only about 3% of IRS agents are special agents with guns. And so I think the images conjured up of a new force of IRS agents running roughshod over taxpayers is exaggerated.
Let's talk about some of the problems the funding was supposed to help solve. First of all, backlogs with the IRS. I mentioned I invited people to say if they'd had trouble reaching the IRS. I did. I had a kind of a basic question, and it took a lot of phone calls. What are we seeing when it comes to backlogs with taxpayers trying to call in, tax preparers trying to call in, and not always getting through?
Well, backlogs have been a disaster. Unopened mail has been a disaster. Tax refunds. People have waited years for refunds. The IRS is making some progress to reduce the backlog reported today, and I expect that progress will be accelerated with more money. The IRS is already spending some of that money, part of the $80 billion, for this next year, this 2023 audit season. And so, tax return season. And so I think we've seen some help, and we'll see more in the months to come and presumably in the years to come as well. But it's been a real problem. That's the service element of Internal Revenue Service. Of course, there's also the enforcement element.
We're talking to Steve Rosenthal from the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., looking at IRS funding, some new funding from the Inflation Reduction Act. House Republicans voted to cancel much of that funding, symbolic mostly because the Senate probably won't. There could be efforts in the future, though. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Joe is with us in Eau Claire. Joe, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My main concern with funding being stripped away is the inability to enforce large corporations paying their fair share of taxes. When we consider the infrastructure, whether that's roads, schools, and any number of public, transportation options, all of the things that our tax money goes to support, we continue to hear of these large corporations that are not paying taxes. And so my main concern, if this funding were to go away, is, is that even a viable thing to hold these large corporations accountable? That's just my comment, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Joe, thanks for the call. Steve, you just mentioned there's also the enforcement side of things. What do you think about Joe's concerns about corporate tax enforcement in particular?
Joe focuses on a key problem, that the IRS has been outgunned by corporations and wealthy business owners who have complicated returns, and the IRS just can't deal with them. The Biden administration pledged as part of the legislative process that the enforcement dollars would target large corporations and wealthy individuals and not target those making less than $400,000. Now, mind you, that pledge not to target those making less than $400,000 is a hard one to abide by, because sometimes people report very little income and they might have $800,000 of taxable income, but they've hit out. And so there's a little gloss on the Biden pledge to sort of look at historic levels and to do some nuanced massaging of who might yet be in that higher income range. But for sure, Joe flags the key issue. What do we do about these large corporations, wealthy businesses, rich individuals who effectively are audit proof because the IRS can't figure out how to audit them.
Thanks for the call, Joe, at 800-642-1234. Before I go back to our caller, Steve, you wrote a recent piece for The Washington Post looking at the release of former President Trump's tax information. And you write in that piece, there are things in those tax filings that show a need for more of this kind of enforcement of wealthier individuals and corporations.
Well, I think the biggest takeaway from Trump's taxes is that the IRS struggled to audit him. In the 6 years that the committee asked for Trump's tax returns, in the first presidential year, only one agent was assigned to the task. And he was so overwhelmed that he basically outsourced the initial take on whether the income and deductions were correct to Trump's own tax preparers, Trump's accountants and lawyers, agent reasoning that these were reputable people and that the agent didn't have the resources to look at each of Trump's deductions. And so it got a little better in the latter couple of years in that there were a couple more agents assigned, three more agents assigned to the task. But throughout this period, we saw an IRS that was basically outgunned by President Trump. Part of the problem is Trump has had a particularly complicated and sprawling empire. And so just trying to get your arms around that was very hard. Of course, on the other side, people have wondered how Trump pays so little taxes, at least as reported by the New York Times. Year after year, Trump reports zero or negative income and pays trivial amounts of taxes. From 1985 to 2018, he had either zero or negative income. People have wondered about that. And you might have thought as president, the IRS would take a closer look as part of the presidential audit program. But they didn't. They didn't follow their own manual to conduct an expedited or even a comprehensive audit as best we can see.
We're talking to Stephen Rosenthal, senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. We're looking at funding for the IRS after House Republicans recently voted to cut recently added funding for the agency. That change unlikely at this point to pass in the Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how the IRS works, how this funding affects it, what's at stake if it were to be removed? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Stephen Rosenthal, senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. House Republicans voted this week to rescind tens of billions of dollars from IRS funding that Congress passed last year. We're looking at what the IRS is using that funding for, what losing it might mean for the agency and for federal revenue. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Dan is with us in La Crescent, Minnesota. Dan, hi.
Hi. I just have a comment. Thanks for taking my call. I find it interesting that Republicans want to defund the police when it's the kind of police that go after their rich friends for cheating on their taxes.
Dan, thanks for the call. Steve, it's not a complete defunding, but it's a rescinding recent funding. Do you think there's a comparison there?
So look, I really struggle with the Republican demonization of the IRS. I think the prior caller flagged the fact that we all rely on taxes that the government raises to pay for the services we demand. As Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, taxes are what we pay for a civilized society. And I think the notion of beating up on the IRS and demonizing IRS employees tends to cause the IRS to perform worse, attract fewer people. And the consequence is some of the people calling for the initial cuts use that as an excuse to cut even further. Look, we need to punish the IRS because it fell down on the job. There was a slippage. That cycle has been going on since 2010, when the Republicans last took control of the House of Representatives and started gutting the IRS. It happened over the last 12 years or so until Congress replenished a lot of the IRS resources with this $80 billion. In real terms, the dollar IRS budget fell by 23%, and the enforcement budget fell by 26%. That's a real problem, and I think the Democrats tried to take steps to reverse that that cycle and that decline. Unfortunately, the first legislative act that the new Republican-controlled House did was to rescind almost all of the $80 billion. I think it's absurd. I get the talking point. Beating up on the IRS, you know, is an easy target. But I think we need more serious politicians to tackle the problems our country faces, including raising the money to pay for the services that we all rely upon.
Thanks for the call, Dan. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I always pay my taxes and I always vote, so I have a right to an opinion on this topic. I'm curious. I understand our total deficit is over $22 trillion now. I may be wrong, but I wonder what the budget is for the Department of Revenue, the IRS, and what percentage of the money they collect actually goes into the U.S. Treasury. I wonder if you can tell me that. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Steve?
Well, there's a difference between the deficit and the debt, and $22 trillion sounds more like the national debt.
Right, yeah.
As far as the annual deficit, I've forgotten whether it's like $300-400 billion a year now. And as far as the IRS share of the overall budget that's spent every year, again, I don't have those numbers at my fingers. It's certainly sizable, but the money that the IRS raises is spent across the whole government. The IRS does not use its revenue to support just the IRS, but supports like our environment, environmental protection and cleanup, our defense system, various social programs. And so the IRS is not using the money just for itself. Interestingly, if we applied a cost-benefit analysis, I think for every dollar that we give the IRS to enforce the tax laws, we get something like $12 or $13 back. Now, that's not the right measurement that it's profitable to give money to the IRS, because, of course, it imposes a burden on the taxpayers who have to provide information to the IRS and deal with requests from the IRS. But still, you could see the IRS is a profitable enterprise. It's just a necessary service in my mind.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Ron joins us now in Thiensville. Ron, hi.
Hi there. My question is, you ever try to call the IRS? Well, you can stay on the phone forever, and you'll never talk to anybody. There's nobody there. And if you have a little problem going and you get a letter and you kind of write back and this and that and the other thing, it takes you about a month or a month and a half between every communication, and you can't have any specific person to talk to. So defunding the IRS is ridiculous. And the fact is, it's what I think it is, it's just a big little green light for the tax cheaters. And they'll say, and it's great for those folks, but for the people, that honest people that want to pay their taxes and have questions, you're in trouble.
Ron, thanks for the call. Ron, as we were talking earlier, Steve, not alone facing that backlog. We've covered that a little bit. Ron worried, though, that less funding, fewer audits, he says, a green light potentially for tax cheats.
Right. When we collect fewer taxes from those who try to hide their income, that shifts more taxes to those who comply with the tax law. And so beating up on the IRS and making it easier for rich people and others to hide their taxes mean the rest of us pay more. I would just point out one tip. There is a taxpayer advocate out there that if one of your listeners gets stuck trying to reach the IRS, oddly enough, a decade or so ago, we added this taxpayer advocate office to help taxpayers deal with the IRS. I personally might have just wanted more money for IRS service representatives to answer phone calls, but we now have an additional layer of advocacy as another solution.
Thanks for that call, Ron. Keith is with us now in Minneapolis. Keith, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to make a comment that's consistent with what your guest is saying. All those middle, low-income taxpayers who in primary income is wage and salary income, they're paying 100% of the tax due on that income because that income is reported to the IRS. And if it doesn't show up on their tax return, the IRS easily catches that due to the fact that the employer has already reported that income. It's all the non-documented sources of income, sales of assets, some stocks, and other items that are never caught, and that's the sort of income that primarily is earned by very affluent persons, which frankly I am, but the taxpaying public just doesn't seem to get it.
Keith, thanks for the call. Steve, what do you think?
Keith is right. The average worker's taxes are open and shut. They get a W-2, so does the IRS. They get a 1099 reporting their interest and investment income, so does the IRS. 99% of the taxes due are paid. Keith also makes a good point that business owners, especially those in the cash and cash and the new gig economy, their compliance level is really bad. More than half of the income that they receive goes unreported, omitted. For every IRS study over the last couple of decades. That's a real challenge. Although it's funny because there was a dust up. I don't know, Rob, if you saw the new expanded 1099-Ks that would have required PayPal and Venmo to start sending more information reports for commercial transactions. That got a lot of people up in arms because they thought their side gigs would now be reported to the IRS. Their side gigs were always taxable. They were just able to hide the income from the IRS. And I can understand, I'm sympathetic somewhat, like, hey, if you're just, you know, earning a few hundred extra bucks, or a few hundred thousand bucks, a few thousand bucks as a side gig, why make a big deal out of it? But the real problem to think through is every time a dishonest taxpayer omits income, that means the rates are higher for the honest taxpayers in order to collect the taxes that we need. And so we ought to make a fair decision for everybody as to what they owe, and then making sure to collect what they owe.
Thanks for that call. Steve, just in our last minute, this House vote probably going to go nowhere in the Senate. Are you concerned, though, that when there is a spending bill, a must-pass spending bill, or a debt ceiling increase, we might be revisiting this conversation about cutting this funding again?
Yes, Rob. I'm very concerned by that. On its own, the Senate will not rescind the $80 billion. However, these House Republicans are very agitated, and they've threatened to hold the global economy hostage and our domestic budget hostage unless they get what they want. And so there's a big question as to if the Republicans hold the debt ceiling hostage, not lifting the debt ceiling for prior obligations that have already been committed by Congress, if they don't lift that, then the full faith and credit of the U.S. government may fail, the global economy may fail, and so we'll have to see how that scenario plays out. The House Republicans adopted as a rule that they must demand spending cuts as part of the increasing the debt ceiling. Biden has announced that he's not going to give any concessions as part of the increase of the debt ceiling. So at the moment, we're on a collision course.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Stephen Rosenthal, senior fellow with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Joined us to talk about the state of funding for the IRS, what it needs, what it's getting, and what House Republicans this week voted in favor of taking away. Coming up, a Wisconsin doctor tells us about a new drug approved by the FDA to help slow cognitive decline in early stages of Alzheimer's. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.